Hi, it's good to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Well, the religious profile of the world is changing. The world is actually becoming more religious, not less. But living in the West, you could be fooled into thinking otherwise. Atheists, agnostics, or people just identifying as having no religion is on the rise in places like Australia, the US, and the UK. Now, in Australia, we've just had a census, and the number of people who tick the no religion box is expected to be considerably larger this time. But these numbers only tell part of the story. The reality of the world's religious makeup, including in the West, may be a bit more complex than we might otherwise think. And joining us today in the studio to help us think through this question, we have Elizabeth Oldfield. Elizabeth is director of Theos, which is a leading religion and society think tank from the UK in London, and she's just off the plane from London. Elizabeth, great to have you in. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us first of all about Theos. What is it and what does it do?
Yeah, so Theos is a religion and society think tank with a broad Christian basis. So we aim to inform the debate about religion in society. As you can imagine, those conversations can get quite fractious and there's a lot of myths thrown around. So we want to be the people with the best data, the best research to say what actually is going on. And like most think tanks, we have a perspective. So we start from the position that religion in general, Christianity in particular, has a huge amount to offer for the common good, that actually it can be a resource for healthy, flourishing societies, not such a write-off as we might have thought.
What do you say to people when they say, why is Theos needed today?
Theos is needed because religion is one of the most pressing issues of our time. In the late 20th century, it was assumed that it would sort of fade away, we wouldn't need to deal with it anymore. And I think the early years of this century made it abundantly clear that religion isn't going anywhere. If anything, we're getting more different religiously and it's higher up the agenda. So someone who you can come to, who you know will tell you what's going on, will give you a sensible, thoughtful perspective on religion in the world today is really important.
Yeah, so if Theos does its job well, what will happen?
I think the debate will get more informed. So people will speak about religion in public life based more on facts than perhaps on tribal assumptions. And I think we'll deal better with difference. So we'll be prepared to say, yes, it's a bit uncomfortable that we're very plural. Yes, it's a bit uncomfortable that we don't all believe the same things. But we can have a civil, grown-up public debate that helps respect the difference in society rather than trying to pretend that they aren't there.
Let's turn to the religious makeup of the West. Now, the statistics suggest that religion is on the decline. Now, is this more or less what's going on in the UK?
The UK is, like most of Western Europe, slowly becoming more plural. And what you are seeing is that dominant block where most people would tick Christian on a census, for example, is diversifying. So we've got still in 2012, 75% of Europeans saying they were Christian. 4 years has passed since then, four quite significant years. So I'd say that's probably a bit lower now, say 70, 65%. In the UK, we're seeing that trajectory being a bit faster. So the last census, 60%, 59% of people said they were Christian. And in other surveys, like the British Social Attitude Survey, which people tend to answer slightly differently than they do the census, that no religion category is right on the cusp of overtaking any religious category.
Yeah, is it fair to say too that, and sometimes critics of Christianity might be interested in this, that you would acknowledge that for some of the people who tick Christian, it tends to be more of a cultural connection rather than a sort of devout nature of faith.
I mean, certainly in the UK, that's been the case for a long time. Something about having a national church, the Church of England, means that our sense of identity, our sense of what it means to be British for many generations was essentially Church of England. If you weren't anything else, you were Church of England, you were probably baptised, you might have gone to a Church of England school.
You might have got married there, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah. The Queen is the head of the Church of England, we have cathedrals, we have churches, and you know, when people think about Britishness, the Church of England is there in the mix along with red buses and telephone boxes and, you know, the Queen. But I think that is slowly shifting now, and you're seeing a national identity whereby the default, which used to be Church of England, is swiftly becoming no religion.
So what evidence is there in the UK in particular that it's becoming more religiously diverse rather than increasingly secular? I think you'd want to make that distinction, right?
Yes, very much so. So I think perhaps the current most accurate term to use to describe Britain and Western Europe broadly, more widely, is plural. So we are seeing the decline of people who affiliate with Christianity. You're seeing a slightly slower decline of people who attend, and that's quite an important difference. So ticking a box on a census is one thing. Going to church regularly, or in fact believing in a thing, is a different thing. And although those are declining, they're declining much more slowly than the affiliation. And I think you see more broadly in society people not joining unions or clubs or societies in the same way. So there's a broader social trend about the reduction of belonging to institutions. But it is declining. Fewer people are going to church. You also have the effect of immigration, which means that minority religious communities are on the main growing, particularly true of Islam in the UK. And you're seeing this reduction in people who affiliate and tend to be ticking the no religion category. But what that no religion category isn't, is an atheist category necessarily.
Right. So you and others have made this point that those who tick the no religion category, you have to dig a bit deeper to find out what they actually mean by that. Lots of people who tick no religion might be a protest of some sort. It might mean they're saying they're distinguishing themselves from something else. But we need to ask a few more questions of them to find out what they mean, right?
Yeah. It's really interesting how things like the census get very politicised. And everyone in the debate wants to claim their category for themselves, ideally for their organisation or their institution. Actually, the no religion category is much messier than that. From the research we've done, we can see that a very small proportion of those people who might tick no religion are actually consistently atheist in their beliefs or even in their behaviour. So many of them are loosely affiliated, perhaps with a religious community at a distance. And more interestingly, perhaps they have this mix of broadly spiritual beliefs. So most of them will believe something about a spiritual being. A lot of them will perhaps believe in the afterlife. Many will believe in the teachings of a particular religion. They just don't feel that sense of institutional belonging that makes them want to tick that box.
You've made the point in the past that this is of a kind with those who no longer are part of a union, or there's sort of rejection of institutions broadly, isn't there?
Yes, I think we can see that as a society, we're less good at belonging to things. And we're more hostile to forms of authority. We feel like truly free individuals make up their own mind and perhaps are at a distance with some of these organisations which previously formed our modes of community and our places of belonging. So it's quite a complicated category, no religion. And make no mistake, lots of people in there would say, yes, I'm an atheist or an agnostic. It's just that's not what defines the whole category.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and we're talking today about religion in the world. Are we more religious? Are we more secular? Or are these labels too simplistic? We're talking with Elizabeth Oldfield from Theos Think Tank in London. Now, you are, among other things, in Sydney to give a lecture on Is Europe Still Christian? Briefly, what sort of answer can you give to that?
Obviously, sociologically, talking about a whole continent gets
tricky. We'll allow you some
it's a bit hubristic, approach, isn't it? You know, right. It's a slightly ridiculous title. And it very much depends what you mean by it. Historically, yes, of course, the forming identity of Europe is Christian. It's actually Christianity and the Greeks is how it's usually conceived of, kind of Greek thought and the Bible. So that's not going anywhere. Constitutionally, in lots of places, yes, it's still Christian. In the UK, still, you know, very intertwined church and state. Lots of those similar arrangements across Europe. Demographically, I'd say we're on the cusp. Even if you're just looking at affiliation, which is quite a weak category, as we've discussed, in the next few years, I would say it's no longer going to be possible that even on that weak measure, demographically, Europe is Christian, say in the next 10 years. There's definitely places in Europe where that's not true, particularly in Eastern Europe, which we slightly need to bracket out because the effects of the end of communism have meant in some places there's been a resurgence of a Christian identity. But certainly for Western Europe, no religion is the trajectory of travel. And really, no matter what other set of lenses you put on it, whatever else you mean by a Christian nation or a Christian continent, I'd say we're at the point where it's more honest to say no, it's not.
What do you think this trend that we're seeing points towards? So you talked about an interest in spirituality, people seeking a higher power, but maybe not, they don't want to go to the church for that.
I wish I knew the answer to that, Simon. This reduction in institutional forms of belonging is clearly part of the picture. A broader intellectual and philosophical move that, you know, we perhaps see kicking off in the Enlightenment and really hardening in the 20th century, to the extent that, as Charles Taylor says, at one point in history it was impossible not to believe, and now it's just one option among many others. So the philosophical and intellectual landscape mitigates against religious belief. And then there's just a lot that we don't quite know why it's happening. So historical events of the 20th century, the public positions that religion has taken, the differences now, I think, between some of the social beliefs that conservative religious believers hold and wider society, and the conflict around those that is very public, all of that's in the mix, but we don't really know.
Elizabeth, what, first of all, challenges does religious diversity present, and then perhaps some opportunities?
Religious diversity is, I think, if we're honest, for most people in the first instance, a bit uncomfortable. We're fundamentally quite tribal human beings. We feel a bit safer when we're surrounded by people just like us, who speak our language, who believe what we believe. We know that that's part of us, and I think that's not just something that shows up in people who are, you know, outwardly xenophobic or racist. We all tend to congregate, don't we, to people like ourselves.
Sure.
So there is a natural stirring up, a natural discomfort that comes through living with plurality, living with difference. But if we allow it to be, I think that can be a very healthy and a very energizing place to be. Difference, we know, can create societies that grow up, that actually listen to others, that learn to negotiate, that learn to share the public square. Jonathan Sacks talks about the dignity of difference, and it's really interesting that actually in the Christian and Jewish theological tradition, difference isn't something to be scared of. It's part of creation. It's something that we should expect. And that instinct in us to withdraw to people just like ourselves is something that we have a duty to resist.
It's like Christianity calls people to, in fact, this is one of the amazing things about the church when it works at its best, is that it calls you to love people who are very different from yourself. Not easy to do, but
exactly.
At its best, it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
And even within the church, there should be a microcosm of dealing with difference. So we know in the early church, there were conflicts between the Jewish heritage believers and the new Greek believers or the Gentile believers. Christianity should not be a homogenous block. If Christians are living out their life of faith, they should already have the skills of dealing with difference, of dealing with people very unfamiliar to themselves, except on this issue of belief. Looking out, being comfortable, not being defensive, with living alongside people vastly different from ourselves, but choosing to serve them and love them and offer to them what we have for a flourishing society.
Well, talking about serving and loving people who might need it, the refugee crisis around the world, particularly in Europe, is very much on the agenda. The reactions to this are many and varied. You have, in some cases, the kind of people opening their arms and opening their doors to refugees, others wanting to tighten legislation around asylum seekers and so on. But it's also engaged religious leaders, right? The Pope talked about compassion for people. Have the religious people of Europe played a role in any of this?
So church leaders in the UK have been very outspoken about the need to have a generous posture, particularly to those fleeing persecution, fleeing war, fleeing the threat of death. There's a big campaign at the moment. The bishops in the House of Lords have been very vocal about these unaccompanied refugee children who are stuck in Calais, in that dreadful jungle refugee camp, and really putting a lot of pressure on the government to say, these are 300 children. We have the resources to take 300 children. And that moral voice is still very strong in the UK. Often it is religious voices that are speaking up for those in need, those marginalised, those fleeing persecution, and saying sometimes this humanity that we share should trump our nation states, should trump to an extent our self-interest. Alongside that, you have the interesting thing that Christian identity is often co-opted by those on the other side of the argument. So you see in Hungary a particular kind of Christian nationalism right from the top, from the leader of the country, saying, we will accept Christian refugees, but we will not accept Muslim refugees. And organisations like Britain First in the UK, recently very controversial because of some association with the death of the murdered MP, standing outside mosques with crosses and trying to be anti-immigration because of or using the language of Christianity to defend that. I think that's when we need to really interrogate those categories and say there's a loose national affiliation with Christianity on one side, and then there's a really theologically thought through practicing form of Christianity on the other side. And one is a more genuine response than the other.
Yes, we sometimes say which one of these looks like it's being true to the faith that it's proclaiming. And it seems kind of more obvious, doesn't it?
When you it look should, but way. I don't think we need to not underestimate in the public narrative how much those differences get lost and the importance of saying this is not these nationalistic and very other phobic responses to something like the refugee crisis are not a genuine Christian response.
No, and then you think about the particular case here of Islam and the migration from places that are Muslim, and of course comes with that the fear of and the threat of terrorism. And so we're getting sort of again the sort of the reaction of fear on the one hand, and then others saying no, we need to welcome people. I wonder, do you think on that particular question, does Christianity itself have something to offer in that kind of discussion?
Islam is clearly high up on the public agenda when it comes to public forms of religion, and not for particularly pretty reasons, as we know. Christians, like everyone else in society, are worried about terrorism. Security is an issue. But it's very, very important that we do not allow this pressing issue of terrorism to remove the undergirding values that a lot of our Western countries are built on, many of which drew very deeply on scripture and on Christian thought, which refuses to demonize whole blocks of people. There is a very urgent moment, I think, and we see it in the States, we see it in Western Europe, I gather you're seeing it here, where a retreat to tribalism and a demonization of all Muslims could lead us into some quite unhealthy situations when it comes to religious liberty, when it comes to civil rights. And I think Christians who have this heritage to draw on of saying we will not be afraid of one particular people group, we will deal with justice and with severity with those who cause harm to others, but we believe that every individual is made in the image of God, no matter what your religious beliefs are, and we will not prejudge you or allow a society to become prejudiced against you because of the colour of the skin or your surname. It's a deeply unjust situation, and Christians should be some of the loudest voices against it.
Yes, and as you think about, and you have a lot of time to think about this sort of stuff, but the way in which we can live together really well, even with very different beliefs, what's the way you'd sort of sum that up?
We did some really interesting research about community organising, which originally came from the States. Barack Obama's very famous for having been a community organiser. And it essentially means local institutions coming together to deal with local problems. What's really interesting is local institutions are disproportionately faith institutions. So you'll have a Catholic church working with a mosque, working with an Anglican diocese, working with a school, working with a union. And what we found is there's a huge amount of difference there. You know, you will find a union member disagreeing very strongly with someone from the mosque or perhaps from the Catholic Church on gender. But coming together to solve local problems and refusing to apply a sort of progressive test to who you'll work with and who you won't creates situations where you can talk about difference, where you can focus on the things that you agree with, where you can live together really well. I think increasingly in the West, we are veering towards one of either pole. One is a tribalism, bedding down into our identity differences and fighting for our rights as individual communities, which can be very harmful, or trying to say that's too scary, so we'll just pretend we're all the same and we'll try and flatten out society and push difference to the edges. They're both understandable human responses, but they are not healthy responses. And holding our nerve in that middle ground of looking each other in the eye and saying, I disagree with you on this, but I'm going to work with you on this, is how societies grow up.
Yeah, I like that. And I think the idea of that working together on particular projects seems to have great potential. And, there's lots of examples of that, aren't there? Well, perhaps finally then, as you think about this sort of work and you're engaged in what you do at Theos, does the current situation and some of these examples that you've shared make you more optimistic, or are you thoroughly depressed?
As a researcher, I'm someone who sees complexity. So I look in one place and I put my head in my hands and weep. And then I look in another place and I see a bubbling up of hope. And in particular, in many places, a set of churches or Christian organisations really stepping up to serve a society, really getting comfortable with not being in the majority and saying, that's all right, that's happened throughout history. We see it in the early church. You know, we don't need privilege, we don't need power. We just need this message of hope that we can use to motivate us to be the best citizens in society, to be the best people loving our neighbour. And that is really authentic and exciting.
Well, Elizabeth Oldfield, it's great to have you in Australia and in the studio to talk about this. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Simon Smart and you've been listening to Life and Faith. We hope you've enjoyed this chat with Elizabeth Oldfield, Director of Theos Think Tank in the UK. If you want to hear more conversations like this one, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity into the search box to find us. Next week, we explore science, evolution, and biblical faith.